apartheid state of South Africa instituted proceedings against the Israeli occupation for their genocide against the Palestinian people. South Africa made a compelling case, evidencing clearly that the Genocide Convention has been violated under several categories.
What South Africa has done is point very specifically to the violations of the Genocide Convention, Articles 2A, 2B, 2C and 2D, across all levers of depriving the Palestinians of food, of water, of displacement and of killing of civilians.
In addition to the large pro-Palestinian crowds gathered outside of The Hague, demonstrating their support for a ceasefire, of which included prominent political figures from Ireland, Barcelona, Belgium and the UK, 900 popular movements, unions, political parties, faith-based and secular organizations have signed an open letter backing South Africa's case. Representatives of the occupation regime sought to blame the resistance and called the picture painted in court distorted and a manipulative description of reality. In ignoring the context of the 75-year occupation, their defense has been labeled as illogical and a desperate attempt to score points. What is also on trial here is the United Nations' ability to deliver on its own promises.
This is one of the biggest tests in modern times for the West, for democracy, and for international institutions such as this. And I'm hoping that they can rise to the challenge.
The repetition of the propaganda they've peddled these past 3 months will not work this time. We have seen the mask fall, and the Western world, which has long portrayed itself as the bastion of democracy, now has to prove that it can extend those same rights to the global South. Latifa Abu Chakra, the International Court of Justice, The Hague.
A report leaked to the Washington Post revealed major concerns about Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, who is currently indicted on corruption, bribery, and fraud charges. Washington reportedly fears that Netanyahu views a long war with Palestine, which also expands to include Lebanon, as the, quote, key to his political survival. Many are shocked that Israeli politicians could have murdered over 23,000 innocent Palestinians and wounded 60,000 others so far just to stay in power and out of prison.
The power is in the hands of the United States. And if the United States thinks that this is happening, then they could stop it from happening today. And that is, in essence, the issue here. I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not going to psychologize about whether Netanyahu is a psychopath, a megalomaniac, somebody who just wants to stay in power for as long as he can stay in power. I do believe that he'll be gone as soon as this crisis is over.
If perception takes root that Netanyahu is fomenting what is denounced worldwide as genocide for personal gain, then U.S. public opinion may turn against continued armed support for Israel, without which Tel Aviv's war aims would likely crumble immediately. Polls now show support for Palestine has doubled since the start of the conflict. It's mainly being driven by young adults, with nearly 70% of people under the age of 35 saying they disapprove of Israel's actions since October 7th. The report came on the eve of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's latest trip to Israel. Blinken made the usual proclamations of unshakable U.S. support for Israel, despite all the war crimes.
I think Biden is in the grip of neocons like Blinken and Victoria Nuland, who want to play with the world as their toy and break it, and who think they can get away with and risk everything and get away with everything. And if they can't, it's no skin off their nose. It's the world and the United States that suffers. So it's been shocking and horrible, but not that surprising to see Biden go 100% in for the genocide occurring in Gaza right now.
The Washington Post's article included a secret report from the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. It cast major doubt that Israel can even defeat Hezbollah, as they are already having such difficulty subduing Hamas in Gaza. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Florence. Francis Mayer Pediatric Hospital Foundation is known in Tuscany for its care of critically ill children. In October last year, the honorary consul of the Israeli regime for Tuscany, Lombardy and Emilia-Romagna regions, Marco Carrai, was appointed as the president of the Hospital Foundation in Florence. Carrai has never concealed his full alignment with Benjamin Netanyahu's brutal policy in the Palestinian-occupied territories, following Israel's atrocious campaign in Gaza, where more than 10,000 children have been slaughtered over the past 3 months. Tens of doctors and healthcare workers launched an online petition calling for Carrai's immediate removal.
Carrai is well known for his position on the conflict in Gaza. Never once has he distanced himself from the atrocious killing of thousands of children and innocent people by Israel over the past weeks. How can he be the president of a hospital foundation tasked with providing medical care to children?
More than 7,000 people have signed the petition so far. According to the UN, hospitals and other vital medical infrastructure in Gaza and the West Bank have been attacked nearly 600 times since war erupted in the territory. Meanwhile, the international medical care organization Doctors Without Borders has been forced to evacuate its staff from Gaza's Al-Aqsa Hospital. The hospital, which serves as the only functioning medical facility in Gaza's central area, has been subjected to relentless Israeli bombing and artillery fire, branded by many as full-fledged war crimes.
Unfortunately, Western countries have gone too far in supporting Israel. 23 out of 36 medical facilities in Gaza have been knocked out. The West's double standard is tarnishing its credibility. The public opinion is distancing itself from our institution.
Also, medics at the only functioning hospital in Deir al-Balah Governorate in central Gaza have been forced to cease life-saving and other critical activities and leave amid increasing Israeli raids, the UN World Health Organization has warned. Max Civili, Rome.
The West has been saying for years that Muslim women cannot progress in anything because of their religion. Iranian women have denied this in practice. Daughter of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, a strong woman, caring daughter, and a great teacher, is one of the most important figures Iranian women look up to. Iranian women have made remarkable progress in various fields, including science, art, and sport, since the Islamic Revolution, looking up to women like Hazrat Zahra, peace be upon her, as their role model for everything they do. Successful women in different scientific fields believe that the presence of girls in academic circles has become outstanding in recent years.
I work as a professor in the University of Tehran in the field of food industry. I'm among highly cited researchers in the international scientific circles. In recent years, the number of our female students has increased. They have stepped into scientific fields and they are very well progressed.
Women have tried to find their right position in the country, the position that they deserve, as they have worked so hard for it.
Today, Muslim Iranian women have managed to make great achievements while observing the hijab and following Islamic teachings, proving Western propaganda wrong. Farzana Shuryan, Tehran.
Under the title, Your Blood Has Become a Storm in Palestine, the Iranian Embassy and the Cultural Chancellery in Damascus have organized a ceremony to commemorate the fourth anniversary of the martyrdom of the Lieutenant General Haj Qasem Soleimani. In his opening speech, the Iranian ambassador in Syria explained the significant role of Commander Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the region.
Both America and Israel are well aware that Haj Qasem played a significant role in the defeat of the United States in
Iraq, as well as in Lebanon, Palestine, and Syria. He had an active and important role in defending the people of these countries. Now, 4 years after the martyrdom of Haj Qasim and his comrades, we see that the axis of resistance is at its peak strength.
Senior Syrian officials, Palestinian faction leaders, intellectual figures, and ambassadors from several countries attended the event. They praised Commander Soleimani's great contributions to the victories of the whole resistance front, calling him a symbol of humanity and resistance.
The martyr excelled with his boundless generosity and absolute selflessness. He embodied the epitome of love and giving. Salute to the brave soldiers of the Syrian army, to the martyrs of truth and duty, and salute to the martyr of Palestine, Qasim Soleimani.
Haj Qasim Soleimani elevated the Palestinian resistance to the required combat level. Everything we witness today, from tunnels and rockets pounding Tel Aviv to the resilience of the defenders of Gaza, is the result of the care and training provided by Martyr Qasim Soleimani for the Palestinian people, Hamas, and the Islamic Jihad.
4 years later, people are still talking about him. He's still alive. His legacy will endure much longer than any of his killers will be remembered. We are here to celebrate a man whose leadership, whose examples in terms of military, in terms of religions, in terms of political ideas, will forever live, not only within the Iranian people, but also within the people of the entire region.
As an expression of their love and loyalty to those who defended their cause, shared their concerns, and gave their lives to liberate Al-Quds, documentaries and photos were put on display, showcasing the life and achievements of the late commanders Haj Qasim Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, Sayyid Razi Mousavi, and Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri.
Once again, Syrians and Palestinians remind the world that the legacy of the late commander Haj Qasim Soleimani will always live on, not only in their consciousness, but rather through great actions and achievements like Al-Aqsa Flood Operation. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Illinois Senator Dick Durbin has been called the oldest friend in Congress of AIPAC, the influential pro-Zionist lobbying committee. Protesters gathered outside his home to demand that the second highest ranking Democratic senator stop supporting Israel's latest war on Gaza. But then activists grew tired of being ignored. Protesters crossed from Senator Durbin's high-class residence onto historic Lakeshore Drive along Lake Michigan. Traffic is shut down in both directions on the most important road in the city in a rare and powerful example of local political activism. Protesters told angry motorists that the person they should be blaming was Senator Durbin.
Senator Dick Durbin actually represents the biggest Palestinian constituent population in the United States. He has a duty to be on the front lines of calling for a ceasefire in Gaza.
When police refused to release one of two activists arrested, protesters refused to move for hours.
This is not a religious issue. It's not a political issue. It's a humanitarian crisis. It's an issue that is affecting everybody in the world, or most people, and everybody wants a resolution. So we hope for a peaceful resolution. That's why we're out here.
The Arab population in the United States is about half of the Jewish population, but Arab influence in American politics and culture is relatively non-existent. For over two decades, open discrimination has been constant, as are hypocritical double standards.
I was in Palestine on October 7th. So I've lived my whole life in America. I lived in Palestine for 4 years, but we came here and I grew up here. I was raised here. But I feel like my identity as an American is shattered anytime something happens. And I see that that my American colleagues and classmates and friends all of a sudden turn a blind eye when it comes to Palestinian life. And it's very disappointing. And it's especially when you come back and you see that your own tax dollars are being put towards this genocide.
Since October 7th, public opinion has shifted massively against Israel, especially among young voters. That may embolden activists to try even more attention-demanding protests against Israel's atrocities and murder in Palestine. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, has said, "If you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous."
Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kabit Akwai. The U.S. and the U.K. have attacked Yemen, hitting over 70 targets in that country. Now, the reason that was given? To stop the Yemeni army from targeting vessels traveling in the Red Sea. That's Israeli-linked, although the Yemeni army has been very clear that it only targets these Israeli-linked vessels and ships. It has hit back at the U.S. for the attack, saying that the Yemeni army's actions is to stop the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. But is the U.S. British attacks on Yemen a way to distract from the genocidal war that's taking place in the Gaza Strip? And if that's the case, does it also point maybe to the failure of the Israeli regime when it comes to not being able to defeat the resistance fighters? Those are just a couple of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Joining us in the studio is David Yahoubian, professor of history at the California State University at San Bernardino. Also joining us, Chris Williamson, former British MP and host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, who joins us from Derby in the UK.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, gentlemen. And I'll start with you, David, if I may. Taking a look at just what has transpired in the past hour or so, we had Osama Hamdan in Beirut pointing to the fact that Israel has pretty much not been able to achieve the goals that it wanted and has, in a sense, been defeated on that in that regard because it couldn't defeat the Palestinian fighters, namely Hamas. Also, you have the Israeli prime minister who, in a press conference, has said that based on the ICJ and how that went down, that we're going to continue with what they call their onslaught in the Gaza Strip. But they both point to the fact that they have been defeated, that Israel has been defeated, along with the U.S., which is masterminding this. What is your reaction to the fact that approaching 100 days, none of the goals that Israel and the U.S. wanted have been achieved when it comes to their genocidal war on the Gaza Strip?
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me. I don't think that the goals that Israel has laid out are achievable. They have neither achieved their goals nor will they be able to achieve these goals. They will not be able to defeat Hamas or the Palestinian resistance. They thus far have not been able to achieve their military goals. They haven't been able to successfully have a release or exchange of hostages or refuse to. So their stated goals have not been met. And I believe that the predominantly U.S. and U.K.-led attack on Yemen is simply an effort to distract world opinion from what's going on, especially not just what's going on in Gaza, but what's going on in The Hague related to what's going on in Gaza, and to somehow try to spin or to change the narrative, when in fact all this is doing is bringing greater attention to the enabling of this genocide by the United States of America, and now with assistance from the UK. So, in short, the effort is to spin, to try to show some sort of resolve, when in fact all this is doing is pointing out in sharp relief the direct support, now direct kinetic support, of the United States and the UK for the Zionist onslaught and genocide in Gaza.
So what do you think about that, Chris Williamson? I guess the key point made there, one of them anyways, is the fact that the possibility of the U.S. and the U.K., attacking Yemen to divert attention from the failure that's going on there, the defeat, really, of the Israeli regime forces. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think David makes a very pertinent point. Clearly, the Israeli occupation forces are not making the progress that they'd anticipated. We know that Britain and the United States have been giving support to the Israeli regime, providing military weapons and so on, and steadfastly refusing to take any action to bring about a ceasefire. And these attacks that have been launched against Yemen, there is no provision in international law for these airstrikes. I mean, it's, you know, in many ways you could argue a case of international terrorism. And indeed, if in terms of, you know, international law, Yemen, I would argue, is actually in compliance with international law, in compliance with the Genocide Convention, which actually provides for nations to take action to stop a genocide from taking place, or indeed to prevent one from happening. And all the evidence points to the fact that clearly a genocide is happening before our very eyes. I mean, billions indeed, not millions, but billions of people are actually witnessing it on their smartphones and on their PCs. And so clearly it seems to me what we're seeing now is an attempt to divert attention. And, you know, you mentioned the International Court of Justice, where, you know, if the evidence is followed, it's very clear to me that, you know, at least a prima facie case has been made out. And that would have a very serious very serious consequence, not just for Israel, but for those that have been, making it possible, as it were, for, you know, collaborating in that genocide. And I think it's certainly arguable that the United States and the United Kingdom, with the support that they've been giving, both morally and indeed practically, with weapons and so on, and indeed, it's even been suggested that there are British and indeed American special forces on the ground in Gaza, and the British government issued what's known as a D notice to suppress information being reported in the media about the special British special forces involvement on the ground there. So yes, you know, I very much agree with the point that that David was setting out there.
What stands out with what Chris Williamson said there, David, is the fact that Yemen was actually adhering to international law with what it has set out to do in terms of wanting the stated goal to be to stop this genocidal war that's going on. And when he said that, it kind of brought back the stated goal of the UN. We're back in 2005, and I just did a quick Google search, the R2P doctrine, where it states UN members endorse the responsibility to protect, which states that countries have a responsibility to protect their citizens. And if they fail to do so, that responsibility, and this is the key part, falls instead on the rest of the world. So do you think that the fact that Yemen has said we're going to target Israeli-bound ships unless this genocidal war stops, the siege is lifted, and then aid is also allowed to come in, that they are actually, in a sense, then adhering to law, just like our guest Eric Wiss said?
That is an interesting point. I would say that Ansar Allah is directly applying the R2P doctrine. Of course, this doctrine, the responsibility to protect, often invoked and utilized by liberal interventionists in the United States or the other side of the coin of neoconservatives to legitimate attacks and the destruction of nations such as in Libya. But I would say that this would be a pure and just case of the responsibility to protect. And I'll just add on the point that the United States and the British, by being directly complicit in this genocide, by not only underwriting it, funding it, giving the diplomatic protection, but now engaging in kinetic activity against the Yemenis, depending on what the ICJ determines relative to the question of genocide, the United States and the British are then going to be deemed complicit with the genocide, if this is what the ICJ determines. And so, therefore, in the context of what's been going on in the last few days, this could be the U.S. and the U.K. attempting, in some pathetic way, to preempt the ruling. In other words, once the ruling happens, it would be very clear that they were bombing Yemenis and killing some of the poorest people in the world in support of a genocide. But until that court ruling comes out, there is potentially a little bit of interpretive leeway for them to therefore engage in this, and the terminological shenanigans of that this is important to defend maritime commercial shipping, which is just absurd and sure. Pathetic.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
The scale of the attack, however, Chris Williamson, in a sense, I think, puts into question what is the UK and the US after. We're looking at about 72 to 73. If the latest attack, which was reported a few hours back, we put that at 74. If it were just some rocket launchers or pads, which they were, then maybe we would say, okay, they're not really going after anything more than that. But the scale of the attack maybe points to the fact that they want the Yemeni army to not have the deterrent power, and therefore perhaps the some that are speculating that they may want to take over that area, which is the Bab el Mandab and the Port of Hodeida, in order to take control basically of the Red Sea and the transit routes there. Do you think that is the intention of the U.S. and the U.K.?
Well, certainly, look, imperialist powers like, you know, Great Britain and the United States, you know, have a record, don't they, going back, you know, in Britain's case, you know, several hundred years of using its power to, you know, impose its will. And I'm sure that's certainly what they would like to achieve. However, you know, it's not as straightforward as, you know, some people might think, and certainly the way in which some of the corporate media commentators in the West are sort of portraying this. I mean, you know, they're not taking on a ragtag of, you know, irregular sort of militia here. You know, we're talking about a heavy-duty military in the case of Yemen and Ansar Allah. I mean, you know, they have, you know, significant weaponry at their disposal and, you know, won't be as straightforward. And in terms of the will of the Yemeni people, it's very clear from the rally that we saw, a huge rally in their Sana'a city, with people expressing their absolute solidarity with the Palestinian people and indeed support for the action which is being, you know, taken in support of the Palestinian people to, you know, as you pointed out there, target ships, which are, you know, Israeli ships and shipping, which is bound for the Israeli regime. But, you know, let's look at the United States record. I mean, you know, they've you know, talk about the rules-based order and international law and all the rest of it, and, you know, use this as an argument to justify their action against Ansar Allah and the, you know, these airstrikes. But, I mean, just look at what the United States, one rule for them and one rule for everybody else. It was only last year they seized an Iranian oil tanker. A few years previous to that, they seized four Iranian tankers that were bound for Venezuela because they said that they were breaking the sanctions. The sanctions, let's remember, that the UN Special Rapporteur described as tantamount to crimes against humanity. These are the sanctions being imposed by the United States on Venezuela. So, you know, they have no room to talk. And as I said, you know, there could be very, very serious consequences.
Okay, looks like we just lost your audio there, Chris. I'm sorry, we can't hear you. Let me move to you until we get that fixed. We lost your audio there for a second. Hold on to your thoughts while I go to David. David's going to look at how the U.S. and the U.K. Have attacked Yemen in this case in point. And we're not too sure how much further this is going to go at this point. Yemen has said that they're going to retaliate, if I were to read the words of the Hossein al-Ezzi, the Yemeni deputy foreign minister, who said the U.S. and Britain must prepare to pay a heavy price. This may go on. But the question that comes about here is the U.S. and the U.K. in this so-called coalition that they have, actually, over there, which was, you know, wasn't really received that well, mm-hmm. especially when you have Saudi Arabia and the UAE, for example, saying we don't want to be part of that, is that they're afraid that this strategy might actually work. Do you think that is the case? Because if you really think about it, Yemen has stood up. They've really stepped up to the plate. And the strategy that nobody would have thought, they've conjured that up and they went after it in terms of targeting Israeli-bound ships. How effective do you think this strategy is, and if the U.S. in particular is afraid of this actually working?
I think clearly it is working. I think it is not only working, but it is working as intended, and therefore the percentage of shipping arriving at Eilat port has dropped essentially to zero. And so it is working. It is working both physically as well in terms of the, let's say, how to describe it, the global opinion viewing the actions of Ansar Allah in, as you've said, and as we could call it, utilizing an approach that could be considered R2P to protect Palestinians. This is directly effective in achieving the desired goal, which is motivating the Israel to stop its genocidal onslaught on the Palestinian people. Now, certainly the Israeli economy has been hit hard by this. The United States and the British and this weak, loose coalition, they're trying to put this forward as just a general attack on maritime trade and shipping when Ansar Allah has made it clear that this is directly directed only at Israeli or Zionist affiliated shipping. So again, in short, to answer your question, it is effective physically. It is also effective in terms of the information war and the narrative war, if you will, that is critically important, and in terms of maintaining the vast majority of world opinion on the side of the Palestinians and on the side of Ansar Allah in this case. So in its concern over the success of these actions, we see now these decrepit imperialist powers attempting this pathetic kinetic attack on Yemen in an attempt to somehow change their policy. This is absurd. I think anyone who is a regular observer of politics in the region, say military developments in the region, is well aware that the United States and the British are not going to be able to achieve their goals, and they are headed into yet another quagmire that. The only question will be how many lives are lost and how much blood and treasure is expended by them in the process of them.
Well, it sounds like the sentiment that you just said is shared by so many people, like the images we're going to see now live coming from Washington, D.C. There's been a pro-Palestine rally. If we could take a look at that and see how many people have come out and what they're saying. Wow, that looks pretty big. This is live coming through from Washington, D.C. People have gathered there, demonstrations there, calling for the ceasefire in Gaza and end to the U.S. attacks on Yemen. And it's, Chris, pretty amazing, I should say, that the people have embraced this. Naturally, they should. I mean, really, when you take a look at the genocide, but also the fact that they also came out for what the U.S. and the U.K. did in its attack on Yemen. And I think London also obviously experienced a huge rally today. The aerial shots, the drone shots were testament to that. Tell us the role that the people in general have played when it comes to this genocidal war, in terms of what it did, maybe the divisions that it caused, et cetera, just to take a sidestep, since we just showed some of these this massive rally that was happening in Washington.
Well, I mean, I think what's happening is that the people of the world are united in their solidarity with the Palestinian people. Many people, millions of people, who were unaware of the Israeli regime's utter brutality. You know, the apartheid regime, you know, the daily indignities that they inflict on the Palestinian people are now known by people who previously were unaware of this because of the way in which, you know, the media tends to censor a lot of this information. But of course, this information is now getting out through social media, on people's smartphones, on their PCs, as I was referring to earlier on. And that's why we're seeing unprecedented numbers of people week after week turning out all over the world to express their support for the Palestinian people and their revulsion, their horror at what the Israeli regime has been inflicting. And, you know, I think this will, well, I think it's certainly concentrating the minds of certain politicians. I mean, they are completely out of step. Certainly the Western political class is completely out of step with the public at large. I mean, some of the European countries, for example, have gone as far as to ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. But in spite of that, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are still turning out in defiance of the law which has been passed in those lands to try and suppress that expression of solidarity. And so this is, I think, we're going to see elections, unprecedented numbers of elections, I think, around the world. And I think many of the politicians who have thrown their lot in with the Zionist entity will pay a very heavy price. And I think this will also weigh on the minds of the judges sitting in the International Court of Justice. It should do. I mean, the case is overwhelming. And, you know, what could happen, you know, if that that decision goes the way indeed it should do, is it could lead to Israel being suspended from the United Nations. It could result in Palestine being admitted as a full member. It could result in an international criminal tribunal being established to prosecute the Israeli officials who are responsible for ordering this genocide, but it also has implications, as I was mentioning earlier, for those who are complicit with the genocide, and that includes politicians, particularly in the United Kingdom and the United States of America, but also really right across the Western world. You know, they really, I think, will be looking over their shoulder, and you know, the course of history could indeed turn very favourably in favour of the Palestinian people, and could be decisive in terms of you know, the future of Palestine the future of the Zionist entity. This could be a pivotal year, it seems to be, in the Palestinian struggle, which, as we know, has been going on now for well over 70 years.
Indeed. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We have to end it here. Thank you so much, Chris Williamson, former British MP and host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, and also David Yacoubian in the studio. Pleasure to see you. Professor of History, California State University, San Bernardino. Thank you so much to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikavi Tarveh and the team, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A recent survey has revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's support has collapsed among young Americans, with 68% of those under the age of 30 saying he should not run again for president in 2024. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Newsweek magazine has covered the story and tells us more. According to polling data, President Joe Biden's current approval rating is lower than that of the last four presidents who failed to win a second term in office. Joe Biden's popularity among voters has been a major talking point in the 2024 campaign. His approval ratings, percentage-wise, has steadily been in the low 40s for most of his presidency. According to poll aggregator 538, it was at its highest point when Joe Biden first took office in January of 2021 at 53.1%, and at its lowest point in July of 2022 at 38.2%. A recent opinion poll conducted by American Research Group from 17th to 20th of December found that 37% of Americans approve of Joe Biden's handling of his presidency, while 57% disapprove. The opinion poll surveyed 1,100 adults living in the continental United States and had a margin of error of 3 percentage points. Looking at how Biden's popularity fares compared to past incumbents who lost their re-election campaigns, he has a lower approval rating than Donald Trump, George H.W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, and Gerald Ford at the same point in their presidencies. On the 1,074th day of Donald Trump's presidency, he had a 42.5% approval rating, compared to Joe Biden's 39.3%. Donald Trump later lost the 2020 election to Joe Biden. There will likely be a rematch between Trump and Biden in 2024, as Biden is a Democratic incumbent and Donald Trump is the current front-runner for the Republican nomination. Former Republican President George H.W. Bush had a 51.8% approval rating on his 1,074th day in office, which is 12.5 percentage points ahead of Joe Biden at the same point in his presidency. George W. Bush then lost the 1992 election to Bill Clinton, a Democrat. Biden's approval rating is about 10 percentage points behind former Democratic President Jimmy Carter's at this point in their presidencies. On the 1,074th day of the Carter administration, President Jimmy Carter had a 49.2% approval rating. Carter lost to Republican candidate Ronald Reagan in the 1980 presidential election. Former Republican President Gerald Ford lost the 1976 election to Jimmy Carter, but his circumstances were different. Gerald Ford, former President Richard Nixon's vice president, took office in 1974 after Richard Nixon resigned following the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford was only president for 895 days. On his 855th day in office, he had an approval rating of 44.5%. On Joe Biden's 855th day in office, he had an approval rating of 41%. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. A recent opinion poll shows 6 in 10 voters, including nearly one-third of Democrats, say Joe Biden should not run for president in 2024. Also, in a further alarming sign for Joe Biden, almost half of Democrats say it is not too late for the 81-year-old to be replaced as their party's nominee. The extensive survey conducted jointly by the Daily Mail and JL Partners poll showed 60% of the American public think Joe Biden should not seek re-election, with only 34% saying he should, and 6% expressing no opinion. Perhaps the most troubling revelation for the White House will be that even 29% of Democrats said Joe Biden should not run for president again. The latest set of alarming results for the Biden administration come less than 24 hours after a Daily Mail opinion poll revealed former President Donald Trump is ahead by 4 percentage points nationwide. The opinion poll revealed results for male and female voters were virtually identical. It showed Joe Biden's support has collapsed among young American voters, with 68% of those under the age of 30 saying he should not run again, the most of any age group. In every age group, over 50% of voters thought he should drop out of the race. Majorities of both college graduates and non-graduates also agreed. There were signs of Biden losing support in his Democrat base, with 59% of Hispanic voters and 49% of black voters saying he should not be the Democratic Party's nominee. And there were further worrying signs for the president, with 65% of independent voters saying he should not run again, with only 26% believing that he should. Winning over independents will be crucial if Joe Biden is to defeat the likely Republican nominee Donald Trump in 2024. The opinion poll showed more Democrats believe it is not too late to ditch Joe Biden than those who think the time has passed. It revealed 44% of Democrats think it is not too late, while 42% say it is too late. Among independents, 66% thought it was not too late to replace Joe Biden, and 71% of Republicans agreed. Majorities of white, Hispanic, and black voters all agreed it was not too late to find another Democratic nominee. Scarlett McGuire, director of JL Partners pollster, said, "Voters continue to have serious doubts about Joe Biden's ability to mount another presidential campaign, while an astonishing 6 in 10 say that Joe Biden should not run for the Oval Office again, including 1 in 3 Democrats," she added. She added, "There are clear concerns about the president's age and his time in office." Fox News Channel has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a new national public opinion survey, only one-third of Americans gave President Joe Biden a thumbs up on the job approval rating he's doing in the White House. The president stands at 34% approval in a Monmouth University opinion poll released recently, with 61% giving Joe Biden a thumbs down on his job performance. The president's approval is at an all-time low in Monmouth University polling since Joe Biden took over the White House nearly 3 years ago. Americans questioned in the survey gave the president particularly low marks for his handling of immigration, 26%, and his handling of inflation, 28%. Patrick Murray, director of the Monmouth University Polling Institute, highlighted The Biden administration keeps touting their infrastructure investment and a host of so-called positive economic indicators. But most Americans are still smarting from higher prices caused by post-pandemic inflation. This seems to be what's driving public opinion. Patrick Murray spotlighted that there is certainly an element of partisanship in how people frame their own financial situation, which is based in part on who occupies the White House. But even a good chunk of Biden's Democratic base wish that he'd start paying more attention to their top priorities than he is now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.